because you've changed the operating system, you've basically transformed the hammer into a comb.
That's what I thought Start 9 was. Knowing that it's so much bigger than that.
If you want to be independent of the technocracy, you have to do something.
Welcome back. Today, I have Matt Hill with me, CEO and co-founder of Start 9 Labs. And I'm so excited to find out more about the company, more about running a node for those of you who haven't yet discovered how to do that and how simple Start 9 makes it so that you can get started. So thank you so much for joining me today, Matt.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I want to know about the company and about running a node, how easy you make it. I can't wait to get started myself. I have been looking at Start 9 for a while and I think it's time. So before we get into the company, I want to know when you started in Bitcoin and how you kind of got to where you are now.
Okay. It's an interesting backstory. I, about 10 years ago, wanted to build a mobile app. I had an idea for an app. It, in short, was a streamlined method for people to trade shifts. Employees in various industries to be able to seamlessly trade shifts with their coworkers, and to have that happen in a way that, you know, saved time and the managers could approve or reject and people's calendars got updated. So it was basically scheduling software with an emphasis on the liquidity of shifts. And at scale, it was, you know, very much intended to be a rethinking of labor markets, to be, you know, kind of the intersection of freelance and on demand so that people who, you know, require labor of a certain kind can sort of broadcast that to the ether. And then people who are qualified to fulfill that labor can sort of catch it. And the first one to catch it gets it. And, you know, the opportunity closes for everyone else, sort of like a DIY Uber platform where anyone could spin up specialized pools of laborers that are vetted by them and then broker them to anyone in the world who has demand for it. Anyway, it was a whole thing and I got really into it. And I went and pitched this idea at a local developer meetup in Denver. And the guy who ran the meetup was very impressed with the idea. I mean, I was up on a stage like showing charts of like different labor pools and how it connects supply and demand. And I didn't realize it at the time, but was really showing network topology of a decentralized network. And it really caught his attention, and he was a Bitcoiner. This guy was like, hey, I don't know if you realize it, but you're doing something like really in line with my own kind of values and line of thinking. Have you ever heard of Bitcoin? And I was like, yeah, the word has crossed my path, but no, I don't really know anything. And he was like, all right, well, here's the deal. I'm interested in your project. Because I went to the meetup to look for help. I was looking for someone who had programming skills because I did not, to help me build this thing, right? I wanted to be the business side. I had a history of entrepreneurship even at that time, and really felt that I could, you know, bring this to market. But I didn't have the technical skills to actually build the product. So anyway, he was like, you know, I think I might be interested in working on this. And I'm thinking to myself, I was like, wow, you know, the leader of the developer meetup, it's not just somebody who was attending. This guy's like, you know, the real deal. And he thinks what I'm doing is interesting and wants to work on it. And he goes, but first things first, go over to the Bitcoin ATM and buy some.
Really? That's amazing.
Dead serious. It was like part of his prerequisite. He was just out to orange pill people. So this is like mid 2015. So he's just like, go over there, put some money in, get some Bitcoin. I'll set you up with a mobile wallet and just promise me that you'll go learn about it on your own time after this. And I was like, done deal.
He's the other co-founder then for the company?
Not of Start 9. This has, what we're talking about right now has nothing to do with Start 9. This is how I came across Bitcoin. This was my introduction to Bitcoin.
Wow. Okay.
Some developer I wanted to work with strong-arming me into buying some from an ATM. So I threw $100 in the ATM and bought just under half a Bitcoin.
Wow. That's incredible. So that's leads into a whole lot of other things leading to the connections you made. But it's also fascinating to think about how you were creating this network sort of, you know, where people could find these pools of jobs. And that's what Bitcoin really is a network. So that's why you were so interested in how that,
yep.
You know.
I was thinking in a way that reminded him of Bitcoin's, you know, core nature and value proposition, which is decentralization, pushing power to the edges through network topology. And so he just saw a like-minded mind and thought that I would be interested in Bitcoin. And, you know, to my dismay, I did not immediately, you know, dive into Bitcoin and start buying hand over fist while it was at, you know, $250 a coin. I bought that little bit, and, you know, only slowly over the following years did I really kind of, you know, dive in and get it even more. At the time, I was very focused on building what I was just describing to you. But anyway, it didn't really work out with him. He turned out to be not the greatest developer. He was okay, but he wasn't the best software engineer. And he was very flaky. I could not like pin this guy down to work. He was lazy. And just had a lot of different interests. And so, you know, during the process of working with him, I started to kind of tinker with the code as well. And eventually he brought on an assistant because he was telling me that he couldn't do all the work himself. So I needed to hire somebody else for him as well. And this person that he brought on ended up replacing him when I finally fired him. I found it was just like, you're not working out, but this guy's great.
That's great. He really was more like you had the idea, you had the vision, you know, and he was just kind of like, yeah, I like your vision, but he wasn't bringing anything to the table.
He just, to be honest, I'll fast forward real quick. Like at this point, I'm a very good software engineer. I've been writing code now for 10 years, and I've gotten really good during that time. And I say that only to preface what I'm about to say, which is that by and large, software engineers are not. They don't have great work ethic. Like, I'm just putting that out there. There are exceptions left and right, of course. It's just, it's a very high skill, low supply, entitled industry, right?
Is it almost because the software engineers work part-time for companies and just offer their services here and there where they're not doing something full-time? Or is that
it's, kind
of
why? I don't think it has to do with like the intended nature of the job, part-time versus full-time, W-2 versus contractor. I think it doesn't have as much to do with that as it does that for a long time there, and this is starting to change now, especially with AI, but for a long time there, if you were a software engineer 8 years ago of even mediocre ability, you were in extremely high demand. Like you could choose your employer, right? And they would give you whatever you wanted. Name your salary, name your hours, name your location, and they just give it to you. Because there just weren't many good software engineers in the world, and there was an extreme shortage of good software engineers, and there's like five who are excellent, right? Like the upper tier of software engineering, like your sort of mythical 10X developer is extremely rare. So if employers even sense that you might be really good, they just, they told you that. They'd give you the moon, right? And so what this did in the industry was it bred a degree of kind of rest on your laurels and entitlement. Software engineers really did get big-headed, like, oh, everyone wants me. You know, it's like just being the person that everyone wants and having everyone offer you stuff and tell you that you're brilliant and give you whatever you want. This is the culture that Silicon Valley bred over the last 20 years. So anyway, I say all that just to say that this original person who was working on, you know, this product was not abnormal. They weren't, he wasn't abnormal. He was pretty run of the mill for the software engineering world. He was pretty good and he knew it. And he, as such, could basically make a ton of money without doing hardly any work and therefore didn't think he needed to do a lot of work because everyone was praising him anyway. So anyway, I kind of learned the hard way what that industry was like. And also being somebody who, you know, is extremely hardworking and kind of wanted to test myself, right? So I started learning. I started, you know, by asking questions, and I started doing like coding challenges. And then I actually started working on my own product. And the guy who replaced this original guy was actually quite good and very hardworking. And we became friends. And we actually, for a while, were living together building this product, right? So like we were literally like waking up and he was teaching me how to code.
Awesome.
While also building the product that I wanted to build. And I was, you know, learning. And eventually he had to move on. He was burnt out and needed to heal himself from years of just really hard labor doing things he didn't enjoy. And so I shook his hand, wished him the best of luck, and he took off for Mexico and, you know, has been doing his thing down there, and we're still friends, and he's still very much involved in the Bitcoin space.
So he was a Bitcoiner?
Oh, yeah.
And were you, that was that at the stage where you were getting more into Bitcoin during that time?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. By that time, you know, I was even shitcoining by that time. All right. I had moved past Bitcoin. I was already into the next thing, right? Everyone kind of went through that stage, especially before the whole like 2017 kind of ICO utility token crap. You know, 2016, there maybe was still this idea that there was value or merit in some other projects. You know, things like Monero were very interesting at that time. And I, you know, I had caught that bug and was super interested in all these different things. And over the years became a Bitcoin maximalist, of course, once, you know, reality kind of stepped through and I understood the nature of these things. But anyway, so that was my introduction to both programming and Bitcoin. I learned both at the same time. I became, you know, I learned about Bitcoin and I learned how to write code at the same time over the course of a few years. And I've been obsessed with both ever since. You know, prior to those, I was well primed ideologically, philosophically, and politically, economically for all things Bitcoin and cypherpunk and decentralization. I was a Ron Paul revolution libertarian, you know, Austrian economist almost by nature, even though even before I even knew what the term was, right? It made sense to me when I took macroeconomics in college. You know, I went to University of Pennsylvania, Ivy League University, and I called dog shit on macroeconomics. Like they were teaching me stuff and I was just like, this is dog shit. Like, I can't believe that this is what's being taught. And again, I wasn't even aware of the Austrian school and history because they don't teach it. I just knew that what they were teaching me,
it just didn't make sense.
It just didn't make sense. I just like things to make sense. And they were doing this real mental gymnastics to try to justify what I perceived to just be bad economic
mental gymnastics, yes.
Yeah. And so anyway, eventually I found, you know, my roots in Ron Paul and Ayn Rand and Austrian economics and Bitcoin and programming and just went full on cypherpunk, which is sort of where I landed today. And what I do and what I spend all my time working on is technology that is fundamentally defensive in nature, designed for individuals and families, and is inherently political and disruptive to centralized entities and the state.
I'm excited to announce my new website, bitcoinnova.store, for clothing, accessories, and even pieces with a QR code so you can amplify the Bitcoin Nova signal and bring more people to the channel to learn about Bitcoin. You'll also find playlists from this channel and from the Hive Minded channel, the projects I support, including bitcoinblacksheep.com, affiliate links, and everything Nova related, all in one place. And don't forget to check out IllinoisBitcoinCouncil.org. $50 in fiat or sats goes a long way to paint Illinois orange. The greater the nodes, the stronger the network. It's nice to find what you're passionate about. It doesn't feel like it's work, you know, the same way probably for most people.
Oh, yeah. No, I love what I do. I think that's important to qualify with. Most of the time I spend things doing I don't want to be doing. I love what I do ideologically. I think what I'm doing is important and good, and it's challenging creative work. But it's a grind and it's extremely stressful. So, you know.
Ideologically, I like that you said that. It's not like you're like, oh, I totally love sitting here at a desk or at a computer, but you love what you're doing because of the like entire big picture of it, you know, what you're building.
I think that the goal is to have purpose and meaning, not to enjoy yourself. I do not value enjoyment very highly. I think it's overrated, right? I would rather grind and toil towards something that I think is good and important than enjoy myself doing something that doesn't.
I love that. I think it's because you are still enjoying something, but it's not something meaningless. You know, you enjoy things that have meaning and, you know, you're using your time for something valuable, you know? So it's in a way you're enjoying that aspect of it. You're enjoying something. You're just not enjoying wasting time. And that brings more, you know, a sense of fulfillment for you.
Correct. It's fulfillment as opposed to joy, right? Joy comes from my children, right? If I want joy, I go play with my kids. Joy does not come from my work. My work is serious business, and I'm dead serious about it. And if I'm on a good coding binge, you know, and like it's working, if my code is working, and I understand it and it's going well, that is enjoyable. It's not in the same way as like playing with the kids. It's enjoyable in like a flow state style. It's almost meditation. Code is art, or at least it can be. And for me, it definitely is a form of art.
I love that too. I never really thought about it that way because I'm not a coder, but I can see how the intricacies of something working mixed with other things that you're trying to weave together. You know, it's this tapestry. So it is like an art form when it works, and it actually is.
Yeah, it can be, right? Like, it doesn't need to be. When I call it art, like, I would not just from a high level say code is art, right? Like, anything can be art, right? Art is to me, fundamentally, the concretization of an abstraction. So when you take something, some abstract ideal or concept, something that does not exist in reality. So take a word like justice or love or beauty. These are words. These are abstract concepts. You cannot point to beauty in the world. You can point to things that are beautiful, that remind you of beauty, but beauty itself is an abstract concept. And so what we need is physical things that we can look at and appreciate to teach us what beauty is. You can almost think of beauty as this sort of archetypal kind of concept. It exists, and we as humans need to experience it in the real world. And so art is what does that, right? So if you, like, I can point to, you know, furniture. That's something I can point to, but I can't point to justice. I can't point to love. It's not physical in nature. And so the work of the artist is to take those concepts and bring them into an experiential, to derive them from the abstract into the concrete so that somebody can experience them. And there's a variety of different art forms to do this. There's music, right? There's all the senses, basically. You can do paintings and pictures. You can do narratives. So literature. Literature is obviously the most powerful of all. Well, I guess they're powerful in different ways, right? Like music is extremely powerful because it sort of makes you feel something. You don't really have a choice. It bypasses the conscious mind. But literature is the most expressive, right? So if you have an abstract concept that you want to explain to somebody, how do you do it? You tell them a story. Right? It's how you teach children about justice.
It's like that saying, like, a picture is worth 1,000 words, you know, but when you have all those descriptive words instead of just a word, you know, then you can kind of put the whole picture together and visualize it, you know, and how you understand code when you use it, you understand music when you hear it, you know, it could be so many different things that are visual or not, but you just have a knowing of what it is. But yeah, an artist is somebody who can give that to you either to visualize or in your mind, you know, with a story or visualize. Yeah, to experience
in one way or another.
Right.
And we sort of need art for this because you can't just go out and experience everything. Like, say, like you want to learn about justice, right?
Right.
In like a profound sense. Not everyone wants to have to go through a, you know, huge ordeal and trial and then, you know, get justice. Like Ross Ulbricht knows justice. Okay. He understands justice because he lived through something that was highly, highly unjust and eventually experienced the redemption and the justice. And so, but we can't all go through something like that. Not everyone wants to go to prison for 10 years to learn about injustice. So instead, what we can do is we can read about it. We can experience it through music and literature and paintings, and try to, you know, grasp as best we can at this concept. And so to bring this back to coding, right? Most people wouldn't think of coding as a way to take abstract concepts and make them concrete, but take something just as simple as cleanliness or organization, right? Abstract concepts, both. When you write code and it is very well organized and extremely clean, not because it needs to be for the program to work, but because it's me imposing my view of the world and my valuing of these abstract concepts into everything that I do, someone could look at that code and kind of understand me.
It's like giving someone a picture of your messy room or giving them your clean, organized home and being like, look, this is who I am, because you could see inside my living space,
yes.
You know, so.
And in that sense, even living can be a form of art, right? If somebody understands you and the way that you live, they could experience the things that you value without having to do them themselves, right? This is like literally what biographies are for. You read a biography about somebody, you learn all about them, and you're learning things. You're learning about life and about things that you otherwise couldn't point to or touch. So
yeah, I love that, thinking about it that way, that seeing someone's code that they've written, you can know what kind of personality they are. Code is an art form. That's incredible.
Can be, yeah.
The world that we live in causes people to be in a state of, you know, like you're just walking through life and you're, you know, not creative. You're just following rules, following directions, following the crowd, and then your creativity is gone. But then Bitcoin will bring more people to a creative place again. And I think that's a really great thing, because we need more creative people. We need less people that are just stuck in this gray world where they can't, you know, express themselves. In this age of technology and AI and robotics, I think that's what makes humans so different and unique, is our ability to, you know, be creative and artistic.
Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin is a bit of an antidote, okay? So we are born a certain way. We're humans. Humans have defining characteristics. One of those is creativity, the desire to learn and understand, you know, the pull to rationality and purpose. And we as a culture and society, to varying degrees of intent, beat that out of children. We, like, whether intentionally or unintentionally, and I would argue that there's more intent than most people would like to admit, to explicitly destroy those attributes of a young human so that they are, you know, more manageable, more tame, and compliant with the societal norms, right? And this is all for the sake of the power and the perpetuation of power, right? You don't want, if you're a ruler and your sole intent is to continue ruling and maintain power, you really don't want a population of free-thinking, creative, hardworking, independent people. You want a population of narrow-minded, non-creative, compliant, you know, beaten dogs, basically. And so we do this. We, not every individual, I just mean broadly speaking, we, do this to children from a very young age. And I think that when many of us who went through this, of course, discover Bitcoin and we give it the attention that it deserves, right? We create the time and the space in ourselves to understand it. It kind of opens the doors again. If you view it as being poisoned your whole life, and then you get a taste of an antidote, you start to see that you are in fact sick, that you are ill. That's a blessing to know that you've been kind of lied to and beaten, and that you are but the rest of you is still there. Your essential essence remains forever. It's a long tail, right? You can get somebody as low as possible, but as long as they're alive, their humanity is buried somewhere. And it just takes the recognition. Like, if you don't think anything's wrong with you, you're never going to get better. You're never going to heal yourself, right? It takes recognizing that you've been had, that something infected you and you were too young to resist it. It's not your fault, right? Like, children are defenseless. It's the job of parents and community leaders to defend children, and we don't, by and large.
That's why nurturing confidence is so important in critical thinking, you know, but instead you just kind of tell them, no, this is what you should do. And they're like, okay, I don't know how to think by myself, you know?
Yeah, our society is fundamentally authoritarian, right? Everything is based on credentials and authority, right? The person with the most education or the nicest clothes or the most money knows what they're talking about and nobody else does, and everyone is supposed to listen. And that is exactly what authoritarians like, is authoritarianism. And that is the dominant kind of, you know, ideology of modern society. And so anyway, when you do get older and you start to learn about these things, you experience a glorious piece of art that upholds the human spirit, not as some low, degraded, you know, we are just specks of dust on the edge of the universe and we don't matter and we're all bad people and we're destroying the planet. And if you get out of that and you for a second experience a work of art, like a book or a photograph or something that reminds you that we're actually divine, glorious beings that are deserving of everything by nature, then you sort of remember it. There's this little spark. And when that thing is also practical in nature, it starts to lend hope. You start to think that, oh, well, maybe it doesn't have to be this way for me or for my children or for my unborn grandchildren. It doesn't have to be this way. We can hear ourselves and our future generations. And that's what Bitcoin has done, is it provides hope because it has exposed a vulnerability in those who would have us be low and defeated. They have a vulnerability, right? And for a long time, I didn't know what that was. Back when I was campaigning for Ron Paul, I thought the way that you would implement, you know, greater freedom, you know, to liberate individuals was through the political apparatus. I thought that we had to march and rally and elect libertarian representatives and get a, you know, get a prominent, you know, excellent libertarian thinker like Ron Paul into the presidency. I thought that we had to sort of like play their game. And part of the reason I thought that was because I didn't understand the nature of their power, right? I thought, like many people, that their power lay in politics and violence. And to be clear, the state does have the power of violence. They have weapons and people who are willing to use them to enforce the state's will or whoever is in charge.
And we think we have some sort of voice, but when you think about it in the way of inflation, we have zero vote on that. They print money to go to war. We don't have a voice.
That is the nature of their power. The essence of their power is money. It is the ability to create money and distribute it as they see fit. That is the source, the fountainhead of their power. All the rest of it derives from that. And so when Bitcoin, and I didn't understand that at first, it wasn't until I discovered Bitcoin and started to really learn about economics and history that I realized that this was the source of their power and also the way that we could undermine it. Right? If you take away the ability for a ruling class to create money and distribute it as they see fit, they cannot survive. It is like starving the enemy. They need that. They need that ability. And that's what Bitcoin does. It takes that away from them. But only if Bitcoin itself is strong and usable and understood.
Right.
And so that's why there's so many people in the world today who devote themselves to understanding and helping others to understand this technology. It's because they recognize that only through the widespread understanding and adoption of the technology can it fulfill its goal.
And stay decentralized and secure.
Correct. And that is the quintessential characteristic of Bitcoin, actually, is its decentralization. Decentralization is the primary value. There are other values, but decentralization is the most important. And any value that is put above that would be a sacrifice.
Right. I agree with that. Yeah, because the fact that it is decentralized makes it secure so that nobody can manipulate it and change it. Nobody has the power.
I want to give a shout out to Bitcoin Sovereign. I love this brand. I love the design. Check out this amazing company. Use code Ecstasy for 10% off your order.
To do that, I recently started going to Bitcoin meetups, and Bitcoiners are so free and hopeful and happy because we are outside of that system. We aren't worried about the things other people worry about. So when we all get together, it's not even like we're talking about Bitcoin the whole time. We're just happy to be around like-minded people with common principles. So when you're around a group of Bitcoiners, you actually feel like you're at home. You feel like you can just be happy and have fun. Actually, like, you know, it's such a different feeling. And I think that in a way, having a Bitcoin meetup can kind of be like a form of art where people can see it and recognize it and say, that's what happiness looks like, or that's what hope looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting observation. And absolutely. People can, their interactions can be a form of art.
So going into Start 9, running a note, you guys have created this plug and play device, right? Is that what you call it?
No.
Okay. That's how little I know.
Yeah. So what we have done, what we do, is we create an operating system. Think Windows, Mac, iOS, Android, all the different variations of Linux. These are all operating systems. And an operating system is an essential component to a computer. You cannot use a computer without an operating system. And all the operating systems that are out there today that are available to you, me, and everyone else are designed to administer client devices. These are desktops, laptops, tablets, cell phones. These are client devices. And all the operating systems that I just mentioned are designed specifically to make it easier for you and me to use those devices. And so there's this whole other computer, this whole other type of computer that most people have vaguely heard of, but almost no one has ever owned or run for themselves, which is a server. Right? People have heard the word server. Most people don't know what it means. A server is just another type of computer. Right? Desktop, laptop, cell phone, tablet, server. Okay. And the server is a special computer. It is the brain of the entire operation, right? The server is where all the data is processed and stored from the clients. Okay. So you do things on your laptop and all that information flows to a server somewhere. Many of them, in fact, depending on what you're doing. Each app that you use is going to a different server. Each website that you visit is going to a different server. And that is where all the data is processed and stored. And it's not your server, right? When you use your laptop and you go to a web browser and you visit websites, you are remotely accessing and controlling servers that are owned and operated by somebody else, usually the person who launched the website, for example, right? So if you visit my website, you're visiting my server. And you can think of that as like coming to my home, right? My house, my rules. This is where terms and conditions and privacy policies, and it's because it's you're literally visiting the digital territory of another person. Every time you use an app or go to a website, you're visiting their digital territory, their digital house. And you have to agree to the rules of their house. And everything that you do at their house is monitored, right? Assume that you come to my house and there's cameras everywhere and there's microphones everywhere. And it's like everything you do in here, I can see. Well, that's what happens when you go to somebody's website. That's what happens when you use somebody's app that they've built. Every button you click, everything you do.
That's why I get so much spam.
Yeah. Everything that you do while you're at their house is not only according to their rules, but monitored, tracked, recorded, stored forever. Everything. Okay. And then they can do whatever they want with it because you agreed. You went to their house and they said, sign here.
I don't like it.
Allowing me to watch everything that you do and sell it to anyone I want. And so that is the nature of the internet today. That is the nature of how humans use computers all over the world today without exception. That is what we've built. It's called cloud computing. It is the name that we give to the computing paradigm that dominates planet Earth today. There are some problems with what I just described. The most obvious one is the one that you and everyone leap for, which is just total lack of dignity and privacy. It's like you go to a website and you're not alone. They're watching, right? It's because it's for their business too. They're not necessarily malicious. It's just the nature of what we've built.
And they want to know also what interests you have so they can market to you and give you impressions to sell you things.
They're trying to make money. So you have this invasion of privacy, okay, which can have huge consequences for some people. Not everyone, right? Like some people, you know, you hear somebody say, like, I got nothing to hide. I don't care if Google's watching everything that I do. That is an extremely naive and also privileged statement, okay? So one, you have no idea how this information can be used against you now or into the future, especially if the political winds change in ways you don't expect. You will always be held accountable for the things you used to say, even if they were fine to say today, okay? So private spaces are extremely important to the maintenance of a free society. And they are also extremely important to basic human dignity, right? Everywhere you go, every step of the day is monitored, tracked, surveilled, and sold to everyone who has a microphone or a camera. You're not really living a dignified life, right? It's kind of embarrassing to not be able to just interact privately with friends and family and to be by yourself. The consequences of using other people's servers, okay? So when you open up your phone and your laptop and you go to a website or use an app, you're using somebody else's server. And when that happens, they can see everything that you do. So that's one problem, is it's not private. Number two is censorship. So when you use somebody else's server, you have to agree to the terms and conditions that they set forth. And if you violate any of those terms and conditions, they can just stop letting you use those servers. And one of those terms and conditions might be, you have to live in the United States, or you can't live in the United States. So you could be cut off from a computing resource simply by virtue of where you live or where you were born. And a whole slew of other things too, right? We talk about outright deplatforming from social media, but you also talk about, you know, algorithmic amplification and suppression of messages. So they don't necessarily have to just remove you from Twitter. You could just, your voice can just be suppressed so that you basically don't exist. And that's a form of censorship. So when you use somebody else's server, they are in control of what the truth is. They can make you heard, they can make you not heard, and they can make you disappear entirely. Number three is cost. So when you use somebody else's server, they got to get paid. So you are either going to let them collect your data and sell it to advertisers, or you are going to pay them a monthly subscription to use the software. more and more these days, it's both. They're mining your data and they're charging you a fee. And this will continue. Fees will continue to go higher. Data mining won't go away until it's really unaffordable. There's going to come a day in the not too distant future where people actually have to budget for real what apps they install on their phone, because every single one of them is going to be a $5, $10 a month subscription. And so it's going to be a meaningful expense in a normal person's life just to use a computer.
Right.
And then the last one is it's highly insecure. When you, me, and everyone else uses third-party servers to do all of our basic computing, all of our information is on those servers, stored in a database. And that makes that database very valuable, very attractive to hackers. And so the database is under attack, not because your data is on it. They don't care about you. It's because everyone's data is on it. And in aggregate, that data is very valuable when you get everyone's data. If I can hack one database and get the data of 10 million people, that's an extremely valuable hack, right? People would be willing to risk their freedom and their lives to hack that database.
That's why people get so much like phishing emails and spam emails.
Databases get hacked left and right all the time. And every database worth hacking will eventually be hacked because they're impossible to secure indefinitely, absolutely impossible. So long as they're holding large amounts of data, they will get hacked without exception. And if your data is on that, then you've gotten hacked, even though you didn't do anything wrong.
Is that the central point of failure?
Yes.
Which Bitcoin doesn't have?
Correct. Well, not exactly, because Bitcoin's database is public.
But if you wanted to hack Bitcoin, you have to hack 51% of all the computers on the network.
I wouldn't call that a hack. You're talking about like taking over Bitcoin by controlling the hash rate. And that's less of a hack and more of a brute force kind of political maneuvering tactic. But we can get into that in a little bit. So basically, these are all the very serious problems that exist in the world as a result of you, me, and everyone else just putting apps on our phones and using other people's servers. Seems really benign. But it's actually incredibly dangerous and totally unsustainable. And so what we decided to do was to help solve the problem. And the way that you do this is very simply to not use other people's servers. Don't use servers that are owned and operated by Microsoft, Apple, Google, Oracle, Amazon, and every app provider and every app that you install on your phone. Don't use their server.
I don't even want to wait till this is over to go buy one at this point.
You can use your own server instead. So instead of on your phone downloading an app, and that app just connects to this third-party server that is mining your data and charging a monthly fee, instead of that, what you can do is you can download an app to your phone and have that app connect to a server that's in your own home. And through that server, communicate with friends and family, store your files and photos and share them. Basically do exactly the same things that you would do in the first scenario, except instead of using somebody else's server to do those things, you're using your own server. So you're sending all the data from your phone to your own server at home instead of to some third-party server controlled by somebody else.
How hard is it to switch over from all your devices to go use this other server?
It's a lot easier than you think, but not nothing. It's plug and play in the sense that you can plug it in and access it. But now you have to, right? It's plug and play in the same way that like a garden is plug and play. It's fine to like carve out the space, but then you actually have to grow the fruits and vegetables, right? So it's an ongoing experience. It's not hard. But it's not nothing. You have to do stuff, right? Like,
cool.
Freedom isn't free. I know that's a very trite saying, but like, you really, if you want to be independent of the technocracy, if you don't want to be dependent on Microsoft for your basic computing needs and have them spy on you your whole life, you have to do something.
I'm going to do it today. Like, no joke. This is happening. I cannot wait. I didn't know. I thought this was a Bitcoin. Okay, I want to run a node. I want to support the Bitcoin network by running a node and have it running all the time. That's what I thought Start9 was. Knowing that it's so much bigger than that, because you're also in more ways getting away from control and spying is, I did not know this.
Bitcoin is a very popular application. Okay. It's a server application. It runs on a server. And it's why a lot of people use our operating system, right? So to get back to the, to bring the full explanation back home as to like what we do, right? I said, we build an operating system. So I listed all these other operating systems, Microsoft, Windows and Mac and iOS and Android. And like I said, those operating systems are all designed to administer client devices. If you want a server, if you want to own and operate a server for the sake of using it so that you don't have to use other people's servers to like truly be free and independent in your digital life, you have to know how to use a server. Be like me saying, here's a phone and handing it to someone who's never seen a phone before and has no idea how to use it. They just wouldn't know what to do. They don't understand how Android and iOS work. We have to teach children that. We had to learn it ourselves when it came out, right? And nobody knows how to administer a server. There's like a very tiny group of people in the world who know how to run servers, and they have a name. They're called systems administrators. That's what they're called, okay, in the technical world. Or IT professionals, right? You've heard of IT, okay? So if you are an IT systems administrator, you know how to run a server to some degree, okay? And you're highly employable and you're very valuable because the people that employ those people are the ones running the servers and who rule the world. So it required a very advanced skill set to own and operate a server, whether your own or for the company you work for. You had to be highly trained with lots of experience to do this. And part of the reason for that, the main reason for that, is because the operating system to administer a server requires this advanced skill set, right? It's like an ancient tool, right? The way that people administer servers is from the Linux command line. That's how you do it. You install some version of Linux, you get on the command line, and you put on your systems administrator, IT professional hat, and you hack. And that's how you run a server, which means nobody can do it except for those people. It's like very, very off limits. So what we did was we built an operating system for a server that makes owning and operating a server just as easy as owning and operating a laptop or a cell phone. We made it easy. We lowered the skill required. We lowered the barrier to entry of owning a server. And the reason why something like this didn't exist before, right? Like, why did we have to do this? Why is there no sane, easy-to-use operating system for administering a server? It's because there was no demand for servers. Nobody wanted to run a server. It wasn't a popular thing, and it still isn't. Almost nobody on Earth runs their own server. Now, part of that is because it's really hard to do.
It's very hard to do, but also because they don't know that they're constantly being spied on and their information stolen.
They're not aware of the problem.
Yeah.
And therefore, they're not aware of a solution to a problem they're not aware of, right? So the idea of like, why would I want to run a personal server? Like, go down the street and just tell someone, you should be running a personal server. They're like, what are you talking about?
Same thing with Bitcoin. Why would I do that? You know, it's like, I don't know anything about it. I don't know if there's a problem.
They don't realize the money's broken. Right? You have to be aware of a problem before you start looking for a solution. And even if you are looking for a solution, people are going to sell you more of the problem in the packaging of a solution, right? For example, people are aware that their digital activities are not private. They're aware of that, which is why if you go look at an Apple billboard, it says privacy on it, right? The tech giants are marketing privacy because they know people want it. So, but what I'm saying is they're not actually offering privacy. They're selling you more.
They're offering you security.
They're offering you confidentiality at best.
Right.
Which is tell us everything about you. We promise we won't tell anyone else. That's what they're selling you. There's no way to use a website or an app without being spied on. It's fundamentally impossible. Even if the person who is running the website is the most benevolent good person ever and they don't want to, they still can be forced to do so.
Even with the VPN?
Well, yeah, they can still know all sorts of stuff about you. The VPN provider knows everything about you. Everything. Think about it. When you use a VPN, rather than visiting 20 different websites individually, and each website knows a little bit about you. When you use a VPN, you send all of your traffic through one provider. And so even though Facebook and X and Twitter and whatever, they might not know anything about you, but the VPN provider knows everything. So you're actually just centralizing your profile into a single provider. It's easier to collect information about you. We wanted people to be able to run a server so that they could opt out of this shit, okay? So that they could do computer things, send text messages to people in their lives, store photos and view them on multiple devices, transact in cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, right? We wanted people to be able to do this without involving trusted third parties. And the only way to do that is to run a server. And the only way to run a server is if there's an operating system that makes it possible for you to run a server. And so we wrote the operating system. That's where we started. We started at step one. We wrote the OS. And the OS exists, and it's getting better and better and better. And it's getting easier to use. And that's what we do. So the fact that people buy our hardware to run our operating system in order to run a Bitcoin node is just one use case. Running a Bitcoin node is a very important thing for someone to do. If you are a Bitcoin holder, if you believe in Bitcoin's promise, and you intend to participate both for yourself and for anyone else in your life, running a node is a pretty essential part of that process. You got to run your own node. You don't have to run your own node to like hold Bitcoin, but if you ever intend to transact in it and you want it to be healthy and robust, running a node is a pretty essential ingredient to that.
Let's say whatever website you're visiting and their servers are down, you could still transact in Bitcoin.
Bitcoin is a decentralized network of servers. Okay. So every Bitcoin node in the world, you can think of as a server, right? And all these servers are connected to each other. And so there is no central server. There is no server to go down. You could have internet outages in different places. And obviously, if electrons cannot flow over a wire to reach a server, that server is pretty useless, right? You're still dealing with the physical world here. But it is highly unlikely that you're going to have a global internet outage, for example, for any prolonged period of time or at all. That seems, you know, like, if that's the scenario we're in, then Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin cannot survive without a network of nodes and people mining the coin. So we need the internet. The internet is critical infrastructure.
Yeah, it makes me think that you guys could be like the almost with this. And if you were to implement some sort of a, which I don't know, this is just crazy, but like some kind of Starlink thing, then you could be like your own node and then your own internet like connection. So you don't have to worry about something going down. Does your internet go through the node or does the node go through the internet? The node goes through the internet.
I don't know. I don't know if the distinction is important, right? So the internet is the actual wires, right? The fiber optic cable or the Starlink, you know, Wi-Fi that's being broadcast. It's the medium through which electrical signals can flow. It is the servers all around the world that are connected to each other, whether they're personal servers or giant, you know, megacorp big tech servers. That is sort of the internet. It's the servers and then all the mediums by which they connect to each other. And so if you're running a server at your home, you are not necessarily joining the internet yet, right? You are, your server is isolated. It's quarantined. It's like a private space, okay? The internet cannot reach your server. Other servers in the world, for example, cannot connect to your server unless you let it, unless you explicitly allow them to. But you can reach out and connect. And so, for example, when you set up a Bitcoin node on StartOS and you click start, your Bitcoin node is going to reach out and find other Bitcoin nodes in the world. And there's a discovery process by which it does this. And it's also going to advertise itself to the network as being available for connections. and other people can connect to you. So you've essentially joined the internet, right? You've made the explicit decision to connect your server, at least one thing that's running on it, because you could have lots of things running on your server, but only one could be, you know, participating in this broader community that we call the internet. So your Bitcoin node joins the internet, specifically a network on the internet, which is the Bitcoin network. And it is connected to other Bitcoin nodes. And so it's, you can almost view it like, you know, some sort of subculture in the broader culture. Like Bitcoin is a subnetwork. It's its own private, it's a public network that exists on the internet, more broadly defined as just servers connecting to each other over electrical mediums.
I like that you're describing it this way because I didn't think of them as their own servers all connecting, yeah, you know, through the internet.
They have to be. Yeah. That's Bitcoin nodes are running on computers, right? And computers have operating systems. Like you could run a Bitcoin node on your laptop if you wanted. But while that laptop is open and on and the node is running, it's effectively a server. As soon as you close the lid and turn it off, it's no longer a server. It's back to being a client. Servers are, they're not like a different shape of computer. Any computer can be a server. Your phone could be a server, okay? What defines it as a server versus a client is what you're using it for, right? What kind of software is it running? And, so that's number one, and is it a reachable at all times? That's the quintessential characteristic of a server, is that it is always on and always connected to the internet. It's not a very good server if it's not. The whole point of a server is that you can reach it at any time from any client device, from any laptop or cell phone. You can reach the server. If not, it's not a good server.
That's interesting to think that any device could be a server if depending on which OS it runs and if it can stay on all the time.
It's not even about which OS it runs. For example, I can take my MacBook laptop and have it continue to run Mac OS and it be a server. If I were to install a Bitcoin node on my MacBook, right, and run it and keep my MacBook on 24/7, 365 and connect it to the internet, it literally is a server, right? The difference between using your MacBook as a server and using one of our devices as a server is that ours is designed to be a server. It's like, yeah, you can use things for anything, right? I could use a hammer to comb my hair. And in that moment, it's acting as a comb, right? But it's not designed for that. Things have a purpose. They're designed for specific use cases. So just because you can use your laptop running Mac OS as a server, sort of like using your hammer to comb your hair, you should get a proper comb. So if you want to run a server, you should get a server that is running a server operating system because you're going to have a much better time. It's going to, the result is going to be better.
See, you just painted a picture. You just did some artwork with your words to visualize why, you know, it's important to do these things. You know?
Thanks.
Wow, that's a really incredible description. I'm a hairdresser, so that was really funny for me because just thinking of a hammer. It's like you could do anything. But why would you? For people who were to buy their own server with Start9, how do you find out, like, is there the tutorial section? Like when you first get it, does it give you QR code to follow prompts and how to set it up and what to do?
So first of all, because what we build really is an operating system, and that operating system is totally free and open source software. You can, if you already have a computer, like a laptop or an old mini PC, you can download StartOS, our operating system, from the internet, flash it to a USB stick, flash that device, and like have a Start9 server up and running for free, absolutely for free, with no catch. There's no loss of functionality, no nothing. We just give it away. It's yours. Enjoy. Okay. And in that case, your laptop that you have flashed with StartOS is literally a server now, right? Because you've changed the operating system, you've basically transformed the hammer into a comb. You didn't actually have to go buy a comb. You can just mutate your hammer if you want, okay? So you can take any computer you have, some old 2015 MacBook Pro or something like that, and just flash it with Start OS, and it will literally no longer be a MacBook. It is now a Start 9 server. It's like a brain transplant. You've like changed it what it is, okay? A lot of people don't have an old computer that is, you know, adequately spec'd with plenty of storage and RAM and a modern chip. Like, you want it to run well, so it should be a good piece of hardware. A lot of people don't just have a good computer laying around that they can turn into a server. And so they need to go buy a computer. And there's lots of places that you can buy computers, right? You can buy some.
I have a question. I had recently been hacked because of one of these stupid privacy situations. But so I don't use that computer anymore. I completely erased the hard drive and I just got rid of everything on it just because somebody was in my physical computer. You know, it was the worst. So I upgraded security, changed all passwords, don't use that device anymore, but it is completely erased. But people told me about reformatting the hard drive. If I were to Start 9 that sucker.
Yeah.
That would be the same thing.
Presumably it would wipe the slate clean and start over as a server.
That's really cool because it is a good computer and I could just have that at least knowing it's because I hadn't turned that computer back on because I'm paranoid. I'm a very paranoid person. I'm like, I know that it's clean, but I don't know if it's clean. So
what kind of computer is it?
It's a Dell Alienware.
It should work fine. So yeah, if you want to do that, we have a DIY guide in our documentation. Do it yourself guide, flash it with Start OS. You'll be up and running with a Bitcoin node for free in no time. And it's also just a cool kind of like, you know, like thing to do. Like, rather, I didn't just buy it. I like hacked it together myself. It's not that hard. You can totally do it. And then you could buy one later if you want as well. But, you know,
buying it though is just like, that's when you know it's on full time. You know that you could run your lottery miners through it. You know,
same thing with the laptop.
But it has to be on at all times.
No, well, it has to be on all the time, but it doesn't have to be open. So right. When you install Start OS onto a laptop, we tell the hardware that even when the screen is closed, it should continue to run. So you could literally flash your laptop with Start OS, set it up, install a Bitcoin node, click start, close the lid and put it on your bookshelf and it would literally be a server.
You give people options. You're giving people tools. So if they wanted to do it for free, and I'm really excited because I could just use it and make sure that my computer has a whole new brain in it. You know, that's what I want to do. I didn't know any of this stuff. So what can you do differently with the server actually versus, is there anything different?
Well, a lot of people don't have an adequate computer just laying around. So they got to buy something. So why not buy it from us, right? Like, it's not like we're overcharging, you know, and you're supporting our project. You're helping us. This is how we survive, is by selling these computers that you don't need to buy, right? We're selling an optional product.
So if you don't have a good computer, if you don't have one laying around.
No, not necessarily. I mean, you can go on Amazon and buy a mini PC that is comparable in power.
Stop trying to lose sales.
I haven't even told you the best selling point yet. Is that when you buy a computer from us, when you buy a server from us rather than DIYing, you get a lifetime membership to our private community support channels.
That's
where
amazing.
We staff it all day long with experts who are there to help you every step of the way. If you have a question about how to set it up, boom, right there. Our average response time across all of our support channels over the last 5 years is 3 minutes. So if you need help, which a lot of people do with this stuff, again, it's easy compared to what it used to be, but it's not nothing. The way that I describe this best for like what you should be expecting is like if you buy IKEA furniture or just some sort of like furniture online and it shows up in a box and then pieces and there's like an instruction manual and you follow the steps and then you have this furniture, that's what you're getting. When you do it yourself or from us, right? It is... You have to do it. Now you can do it and the steps are very clear and they're accurate. But if you run into any challenges along the way, we have experts on staff, on call, all day, every day, ready to help you.
Yeah, because when you buy IKEA furniture, you're stuck. You're like, I gotta figure this out. If I need help, there's no one to call.
Yeah.
But with you guys there is.
Absolutely. And it's there and it's included in your purchase, right? For life. You any point in the future, you ever have a question or something is not working, just drop in. We also warranty the hardware. So if you get a computer and something's not right, we fix it, we take it back. So there's value in warranties and support, right?
I love your logo, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, I could see the, you know, that and then the circle.
Yeah, it comes from the A.
Ah, yes.
I took the A.
I love it.
Here. And not everyone sees it, but if you were to cross the A.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where is it? Look, I've got my Satoshis on and they have the anarchy symbol. That's amazing. So cool. And that's always the kind of person you were, looking for, you know, critical thinker, questioning things that don't make sense and making things make sense. I am checking out Start 9 and thank you so much for joining me and teaching me about this.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
You're doing incredible work and it does feel very important and fulfilling to do this. I mean, to give people tools and options and freedom. And when it comes to Bitcoin, running your own node is a way to participate in the network, you know? So it's like a lot of people buy Bitcoin, but they don't run a node. But running a node is...
citizenship. I refer to it as like citizenship, right? You can visit a country, you can even invest in something, but you don't get a say. You're not a citizen. You don't get to vote. You have no power or rights unless you are running a node. I shouldn't say it's the only way. There are other ways to be political in Bitcoin. For example, you could be Michael Saylor and have tons and tons of Bitcoin and say things that, you know, move markets. But for most people, realistically, the only way that you're going to achieve any degree of political power in Bitcoin is by running a node and participating in the what is the decentralized democratic process of the Bitcoin network.
And do you also, the last question, do you also have, because of all the core knots people out there, I think I had seen something that it was you had to do an extra step to implement knots, but now is it just easier to implement knots if people wanted to?
Yeah, so we have a bug in the current operating system that we didn't foresee because we didn't see the core knots thing coming. And so, you know, it's very important to our operating system that Bitcoin Core and Bitcoin Knots both have the same ID. They need the same identifier because other services are looking for them. Like your Lightning node is looking for the Bitcoin node. And so how does it find it? It finds it by an identifier. And so these identifiers collide. These are two different services and you can't have them both installed because then it's like all hell breaks loose because nothing knows what Bitcoin is anymore on your system. So you have to have one or the other. And we couldn't host them on the same registry either, like where you download the software, because the same problem would occur. The registry wouldn't know what to do with these duplicate services. So we had to put, right, Knots on the community registry. And the reason why we put Knots on the community registry and not Core is because Core was there first. We didn't think it was appropriate to like play that kind of opinionated thing. Like we try to be as neutral as possible.
Yeah, you're just
personally, I have opinions, but as a company and as a technology, we try to be as neutral as possible. So Core was already there. So we put Knots over here. And so in order to install Bitcoin Knots, you have to switch registries. It's literally a button. There's a button that says switch and you click it and then you click the other one and now you're there. So it's like really, really minimal added effort. But even that is going away in the next version of StartOS when the bug is fixed. They'll be on the same registry side by side and your system knows how to tell the difference now. But it's not out yet. It's not released yet.
Okay. Would you still have to choose one or the other?
Yes. No, and we think that that's important because it's a lot of system resources. People would not realize that they were, by installing like two Bitcoin nodes on their system, not only would that result in double IBD and double blockchains and like totally unnecessary, by the way, to do that, but also you'd have the same problem of, say, like you install a Lightning node. How does that Lightning node know which one to use? We would have to encode into the Lightning node the ability for the user to choose which Bitcoin on their system they want to use.
It's unnecessary clutter, right? I mean,
it's an edge case thing that we're not going to cater to because there's already a simple solution in place. Run a different server.
Right.
If you want to run both of these things or whatever, you get two servers.
Right. What That's true.
You don't need to run them both on one server, get two servers.
That's very true.
Nobody needs to do that. And if you want to do that, we should talk because it doesn't make sense. There's no reason to run two Bitcoin nodes. Zero.
I've heard people say that too.
There's no reason. You do not have more power as a result of it. The network is not better off as a result of it. And if you're running both Core and Knots, you're literally just contradicting yourself.
Yeah, you're just like voting against yourself. Well, thank you so much for your explanation, your visualization, the way that you painted the picture for us. I love what you're doing. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Very nice. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Have a great day.